Okay, we're resuming our talk, Daniel, about the National Theatre and your book, The National Theatre Story. I think we've got to Peter Hall, really. And before we talk about him, I'd just like to look back again at Olivier to ask you about the new writing that you mentioned. Because for me, I can think of a handful of plays. What are the ones that stand out for you?
In the Olivier tenure, Peter Schaffer, he wasn't quite the house dramatist, but had The Royal Hunt of the Sun in 64, made a huge impact. Black Comedy the following year made a huge impact. And then Equus was a sensation. And it's still around number 17 on the list of the longest running plays on Broadway. And you think, you know, think of the hundreds and thousands of plays that have run on Broadway, and Schaffer's ability to write plays that connected with an audience, and John Dexter's ability to realise those plays, and which Schaffer always credited, and then they subsequently fell out and, over Amadeus. So you've got the three Schaffer plays, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, which becomes this huge hit. But for me, the really arguably the most important play at the Old Vic in pointing towards new writing in the South Bank building is Peter Nichols' The National Health in 1969, because it does qualify as the first State of the Nation NT play at the National Theatre when it was at the Old Vic. And that's why it's so significant that Olivier's objections to that play, and I spend a long time in the chapter on the National Health in the book dealing with this, that Olivier, you know, was reluctant to let the play go on, and then sort of tried to kill it and didn't give it enough performances in the rep, and Michael Blakemore, who was directing it, went behind Olivier's back, and he got Irving Wardle, then the drama critic of the Times, to come and re-review it. And Olivier buttonholed Blakemore and said, "How dare you? You went behind my back. You got Wardle back." Mm-hmm. Peter Nichols was infuriated by this, was writing to his agent, Peggy Ramsey, saying, you know, what's going on? The actors were fed up. And it does reflect on Olivier that his sensibility, you know, he Blakemore talks about him rather kowtowing to authority figures, and he regarded medicine as doctors he thought had saved his life, so he was perhaps too deferential to medicine, to doctors and consultants rather, and that the portrait of the National Health as it was then, he didn't like it. And, you know, it was scatological, there was bad language, and yet rereading the play, some of it has dated. But, you know, to anybody who's been in hospital, to anybody who's had an elderly relative in hospital, when one of the patients complains, say, you know, in here, they wake you up to give you a sleeping pill, you know, that you cannot,
like that.
You cannot read that line and not think about, great though it is, the NHS today. Yeah. And it's very striking that subsequent directors of the National talk about their love of the National Health, and Richard Eyre talks about, shall I revive it? Shall I revive it? And he just felt it was of its time. And I was really, at the personal level, I was thrilled that the National Health was included in the 50 Years on Stage gala. And it was included as that first State of the Nation play.
Peter Hall, obviously another gigantic figure. You've already mentioned him. Could you say something about what you think his achievement was? Was it to create this building and to sort of... I mean, some of the details you give are just extraordinary, how bad or how long the builders took to actually construct it. It's almost unbelievable.
Yeah. Peter Hall chooses as his own epitaph that he says, you can put that I created the National I created the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I opened the South Bank. And he says that should be a footnote. It is, of course, infinitely more than that. The acceptance from even those who felt that Peter Hall's appointment as director was handled very badly by Max Rain as chairman and Arnold Goodman as chairman of the Arts Council, acknowledge that Olivier no longer had the physical energy to see it through, to prevent the building from being delayed even further. Or there is a theory, it's unprovable, but there is a theory that it might have been left as a half-finished shell, like some hotel in southern Spain. Now, I have to say I don't quite hold to that, because once building has started on a major nationally funded, publicly funded project of this scale, whichever government allowed it to remain a shell would be so shamed, and it would be a monument to their failure to see it through. So I'm not sure I subscribe at all to that argument that it would have remained unfinished. How long, much longer it would have taken, who knows. What Peter Hall did quite brilliantly was to say, we're going to open just the Littleton in March 76. Yes. Yeah. And his right-hand man at the time, Peter Stevens, had had similar experiences at regional theatres, and said that you learn that to finish a theatre, it is necessary first to open it.
Yeah, lovely phrase.
You know, and that phrase, and that's what they did. And Olivier pays tribute to it in his speech on the Olivier stage at the Royal opening in October 76 by saying, we are here because of the durable cladding of Peter Hall's foot when he shoved it in the door. And so getting the Littleton open was a masterstroke in March 76. And this idea, you know, that phrase, if you build it, people will come. If you open it, people will come. And they flocked here and have carried on doing so. So Peter Hall's achievement in getting the building open and then surviving the union militancy.
Yeah, I was quite... You know, in the 1970s, I was a young radical, so in theory, I would be pro the workers. But the details you give are quite astonishing. Can you say something about how much money some of them were making, the sort of backstage crew were making more than the stars or some of the actors?
Yeah. The backstage crew were doing extremely well, and also they found themselves in this position where the very sophisticated stage machinery, the power flying, the drum revolve in the Olivier, the power flying in the Littleton, kept breaking down. And the more it broke down, the more the simple muscle power, the manpower of the stage crew was called for, probably at overtime. And they were able to make a huge amount above basic salary. We have to remember that this was a time where there were national wage controls. And if the Chancellor said, nobody can... in the public sector can put up their pay by more than 5%.
Yeah, it was a wage then, freeze. Yeah.
Peter Hall was had to be held to that. And there are some memos from the union at the time was NACCI, representing the stage crew here. And there are a couple of memos where they basically say, we are above the law. They say, what the Treasury is saying about guideline pay limits does not apply to us, which is their way of saying we are above the law. And Peter Hall describes it as this unholy alliance of far right and Trotskyites. And there was this story, which I don't think I managed to find room for in the book, it may be in there, which is that Sue Higginson, who was then Peter Hall's assistant, remembers that the rough and tumble end, the sort of cockney tough end of the stage crews. So she came in one day, and one of them said, "How are you, Sue?" And he said, "Well, I've just had my house, my flat has been burgled again." And he said, "Burgled? You tell us who done it, Sue. We'll do them in. We'll do them in." And you know, so she has this vision of these burglars being found and thrown into the Thames in concrete shoes, and these were the people who were operating the power flying, and it became. It really did, when I was writing this up, the fact that there was a strike in 76, there was a strike in 77, a strike in 78, but these were kind of a day here, a day there. And then it all becomes overwhelming and bitter and violent in 1979. And I chose to do the 79 strike in diary format, partly because the files kept by Michael Elliott, Peter Stevens' successor as general administrator, Peter Hall's right-hand man, in administrative terms, were so meticulous the files in the archive, so you could see day by day. And sometimes it was Alice in Wonderland. I mean, I tell the story of a goods van delivering much needed groceries to the building, and the driver's trying to reverse out of the building safely, and there's a couple of policemen on the picket line guarding the picket line, and they start saying, "Yeah, come back, come back, come back," and they usher this driver straight into a police van, and he crashes into a police van. And the heartbreaking story which Peter Hall has told already in his diaries of Michael Redgrave, who was suffering from advanced Parkinson's and was appearing in Simon Gray's Close of Play, directed by Harold Pinter, and had a taxi that would deposit him at the stage door for rehearsals. And the picket line stopped the taxi, and they made Michael Redgrave walk from his taxi. He could barely walk from his taxi to the stage door. And the politics, it seems to me, the rights and wrongs of who was earning what, go out of the window at that point in terms of simple human sympathy. That's not about them and us, management and unions. That is just a total absence of compassion.
Now, there were big fights and lots of other heavyweights involved. I'm thinking of Michael Blakemore, Jonathan Miller, directors with great egos but also with great artistic abilities. Can you say a bit about that? How does that look from this vantage point? Was it a personality clash, or were there artistic reasons for?
I think it was both. I mean, these are feuds between Peter Hall and Jonathan Miller first, and then Michael Blakemore, which have been so extensively discussed by the participants in print, in interviews, Peter's diaries, Jonathan Miller in many interviews, in Kate Bassett's biography of Jonathan Miller, Michael Blakemore's new book, Stage Blood. I'm not sure I add in mine a great deal that hasn't already been stated, but it's an important part of the story, because there's no law that states that all gifted theatre practitioners have to get on with one another. And again, I hope that doesn't sound trite, but I think it would be a great shame if, in the case of all three of those great, great directors, those individual feuds were allowed to distract from or overshadow their achievements as directors, both at the Old Vic and here. You know, there was very, very strong personality clashes, which led to those directors resigning. They felt, Miller and Blakemore, that the National changed in a way that they didn't like under Peter, but it had to change. You know, as I've said earlier today, whoever ran the South Bank, the National was going to change. It was going to change from what it was at the Old Vic. And, you know, Peter attracted tremendous loyalty. Something that I do feel strongly about is that, uniquely in my research into personalities and the policies of the artistic directors here, was Peter Hall's ability. It wasn't so much that he polarized opinions. There were people, as it were, who were his friends or his enemies within the profession. It was his ability alternately to endear and infuriate the same person. And in the chapter I have, which is entitled "Is There No End of to Sir Peter's Year of Misfortune," which was 1983, and that's the headline from a Sunday Times feature. What I found so striking there was, towards the end of the chapter, I have Peter Gill and Michael Rudman and David Hare all in that chapter being tremendously against something that Peter is doing in his artistic policy, and also Michael Rudman saying, you know, he writes to John Goodwin, Peter Hall's head of press here, and he says, "Does Peter know how much we love him and how much we're upset by this terrible year that he has had?" And yet, Michael Rudman had a very difficult time with Peter Hall over becoming his deputy and had resigned as a result. So I do, maybe it isn't unique amongst artistic directors, but that element with Peter Hall of, in the same month, one of his closest artistic allies could suddenly think, "Peter, what are you doing?"
Yes.
That seems to me remarkable.
More recently, Richard Eyre and Trevor Nunn as artistic directors, I think they helped redefine the National's mission overall, and I felt that they were both more populistic in certain respects, but also more successful in filling the theatres. I mean, one or two of the shows that you mention in the early days had tiny percentages. So can you say something a bit about that sort of long 20 years worth?
To be fair to Peter, it is reasonably consistent, and this statistic which I draw out is that roughly in the main stages, the main stages here are the Littleton and the Olivier, and that is where, in budgeting terms, everything stands or falls. And historically, the target has almost always been 75% attendance. So you need to hit 750 people in a 1,000-seat theatre to break even on your budget across the year. So that's the target. And across 1976 to 2003, so Peter Hall, Richard Eyre and Trevor Nunn, roughly every other main stage show doesn't quite hit that target. So the populism argument is there, but the consistency of attendance across the Olivier and the Littleton has ebbed and flowed with the seasons, with the years, with different programming. And the National, the beauty of the repertoire system, the three theatre system, is that if one show plays to 55% and another is a sellout, you come out even. The great problem financially is if a show really, really fails and is playing to 250 and has been programmed in such a way that you can't just pull it in the way that the commercial impresario maybe loses money, but the commercial impresario can cut their losses, because if the show's empty and it's had terrible reviews on a Monday, you can close it on the Wednesday.
What about musicals and so on? Did you find a lot of antagonism to the staging of successful shows like that?
The antagonism towards musicals has been more to do with individual drama critics than within the building. And it was particularly towards the tail end of Richard Eyre's time and then into Trevor Nunn's time. It was a simple, pragmatic response to dwindling subsidy and a dwindling core audience for the classics. Peter Hall himself acknowledges that for all his troubles with the unions, for all his troubles with the funding cuts under Thatcher from 79 onwards, he knew in the early years that if he put on a staple of the classical rep, if he put on a Chekhov or a Restoration comedy, let's say, he knew, okay, that will play to 85%. I'm okay with that. And that those days went, and it became that you would need a star name to sell a classic, perhaps. And a production that becomes a sort of litmus test in the book was Howard Davies' production of Bulgakov's Flight.
Oh, yes.
For Trevor Nunn, for which Howard Davies won, I think, the Evening Standard Award for Best Director. And yet, it played in the Olivier to about 45%. Financial attendance. And Howard Davies talked to me about this, Christopher Hampton talked to me about this, Trevor Nunn, they all singled this out as an example of something has happened to the National's audiences. If a show this good, with Alan Howard, with Kenneth Cranham, exhilaratingly staged by Howard Davies, if that doesn't find an audience, we're in trouble. And Nicholas Heitner and Nick Starr's approach from 2003 onwards was partly as a consequence of shows like that not meeting their target. It was a recognition that audiences don't change overnight, but the National's marketplace, the marketplace in which the National operates, was different in 2003 to what it had been.
Yeah, there are sea changes, and one of the enormous things that has changed in London, of course, is the proliferation of other theatres doing other aspects of the international repertoire.
And also sucking up the oxygen of publicity. That's the other thing. The amount of space available for coverage of theatre in the broadsheets, on radio and television is very finite and was dwindling before even Nicholas Heitner took over. Yeah. And if you have the Almeida and the Donmar, getting the features coverage that would previously have been the Nationals, and they've only got to fill 300 or 250 seats.
Yeah.
I was very struck by a note in the board papers around 1990 where a member of the board is asking, you know, shouldn't we be spending, as the theatre, shouldn't we be spending more on marketing? And they said, well, we don't have the resources that the West End does to market its shows, and we're very lucky because we get a huge amount of free publicity through the editorial coverage in the newspapers and on radio and television.
Let's just briefly, because we're running out of time, talk about Nicholas Heitner. To me, it seems that he's one of the most successful artistic directors, not only of the National, but of British theatre. How does it seem to you?
I would certainly agree with that. And a consistent theme throughout my book is what I call the balance between capital D directing and lowercase d directing. What does the director of the theatre do in programming, in producing, in developing new work, and what does the director do in the rehearsal room and leading from the front with shows in the Olivier and the Littleton? And all three of Nicholas Heitner's predecessors on the South Bank had to, you know, balance that as he's done. Can your work in the rehearsal room be at its peak when you're also considering all of the burdens of administration and producing and being the standard bearer, as it were, for the whole of the British theatre in discussion of subsidy, sponsorship, etc.? And I think, you know, I'm not a critic, so that this is not said from the critic's point of view, but I don't think I'm going to be contradicted if I say that productions such as Timon of Athens and Othello are amongst the best productions that Nicholas Heitner has ever directed. And the fact that he has done that, done work of such extraordinary quality whilst being director, is very revealing. And I think it's also important that he followed what I, as it were, called the rule of five. The artistic director here aims to direct no more than five shows in two back-to-back calendar years. The time spent out of the rehearsal room is when you are meeting benefactors, you're meeting playwrights, you're meeting actors, you're meeting other directors, you're just focusing on the direction. And, the book dwells at very considerable length within the Trevor Nunn chapters on a perception that he got that balance wrong, and certainly on the view of his closest colleagues that he had got that balance wrong. But the paradox, as I call it, of Trevor Nunn's tenure is his extraordinary success as a director with the classical repertoire, with the musicals, meant that had he not been directing so much, the National's finances would have been in a terrible state. So there's no way to unpick that.
Exactly.
The paradox of
direction.
But just finally on that point, it does set us apart again from the European tradition of the intendant and the idea that here in this building, and it'll be carried forward by Rufus Norris, the artistic director has to be a practitioner.
On that note, looking forward to the future, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.